Hello and welcome to another episode of the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb, 97.2 FM, online at RadioReverb.com, on DAB, on Smart Speaker, and of course, on our podcast. I'm Ailey Packham, and well, we'll take a point in association with Flowers Unlimited. Well then, we were hoping to be talking about a triumphant victory at Selhurst Park on Sunday, but it has ended up with us being, well, just agreeing that a game happened as a stalemate ensued. However, it was a second clean sheet in a row, and it's another point to the total as we head into yet another international break. So, with 11 games now gone, we can look at where we are and what we're where we're going and what we can do better. In other news, despite the widespread clamouring for Danny Welbeck to be recalled to the England squad, Danny has got a week off, although Thomas Tuchel has revealed that he's still under consideration with the World Cup very much on the horizon. Joining me today is, of course, Alan Wares, and we are delighted to welcome back the Argus's chief sports writer, the one and only Mr. Brian Owen. Hello, Brian. How are you?
Hi, Heidi. Yeah, big build-up. Chief, how many?
Well, that was a big build-up.
Good to keep
I gave you a big build-up on Saturday when I saw, or Sunday when I saw you as well.
Yeah,
so
yeah. Before the nil-nil. Hang on a minute.
How do you actually just go up to someone and give them a big build-up?
I can't remember it, but I mean, it was keep the football ticking up.
Oh, and every time I see Brian, I have to give him a drum roll. That's basically what it is. Actually, it was Brian wanting to talk to me about Jenny Garra. Actually, what really happened? But it was.
Oh right, okay, fair enough. No, that's fine.
That was last week. But yeah. So I mean, the only thing we can say about Palace, Brian, is really that it happened.
Yeah, I mean, I'm always. I've heard it described as a bore draw. I'm always struggling with that because I'm like, when you're working, you're actually pretty busy. So every game is always incredibly exciting and incredibly tense, even a game like that. I don't know if it was, I think mistakes of trying to get that win and not lose the game probably meant people, I'd imagine Brighton fans who were there weren't actually bored. That wasn't a sensation, but it was frustrated a little bit, I suppose, and really mixed feelings, which I couldn't, my feelings personally had probably changed by the time I got down to about Gatwick or Burgess Hill on the train. My feelings at the final whistle had probably switched about 180 degrees, but...
Sorry, from what to what?
Could have been better.
Sorry,
from what to what?
From the very final moments when Verbruggen made that save and they were lining up a corner and you're thinking it could all go wrong. That moment thinking this isn't a bad draw and thinking that for quite a way afterwards, and it's a good clean sheet. And I spoke to Verbruggen afterwards in Yassin Ayari, and it was fairly upbeat and not upbeat, that's saying it too much, but it was okay. On the train thinking this was a chance to actually get a win up there.
Yeah, and I was talking to various people up there as well, including a good friend of the show, Ed Aarons, who's obviously the Guardian's Palace supporting journo. And he was very, very nervous before the game. And he thought that, particularly with the fact that Gaye was ruled out through injury, that it was a really good opportunity for us to get a good win there. But
I just thought as soon as I saw the fixtures and it was 3 days after an international game, I thought that might help Brighton slightly. A bit of a shame Palace weren't in Azerbaijan or somewhere, but that was a home game. But
that's what I was looking for. That's what I was really hoping for.
But anyway, but it was okay.
It's probably fair to say that Palace have actually started the season pretty well. They come out of the traps, and I think they're the last ones to lose their unbeaten record certainly in the Premier League. And yeah, it's interesting. You're talking about Ed Aarons, who is incidentally a very, very good football writer for The Guardian. The fact that he supports Palace is, he'll leak it into his social media now and again. But the point is that even when he's talking about Brighton, I think he's sort of very fair and even minded and doesn't let any sort of prejudices go into that. But it's interesting you're saying about how nervous he was. And I think that probably it doesn't matter. I suspect a lot of Albion fans were nervous, knowing full well that sometimes we've been misfiring, sometimes we've been good. Palace have made a reasonable start. They're buoyed by being in Europe. and it's their first time in Europe, and yet he's still nervous. I suppose probably because, in terms of a local rivalry like this, and let's not call it a derby, let's call it what it is, a local rivalry. When you've got a local rivalry like that, I think that all kind of form and bets are off because the tension is extra. It certainly is amongst I'd imagine the Palace fans were just as nervous as Brighton fans. And
Well,
yeah, and I think some of that does leak onto the pitch as well, and sometimes therefore does boil over. And
well, I mean, what
last
Ed
game
was
up, don't
saying
forget,
though,
last
Al.
game up there ended up in three red cards.
Yeah. I mean, what Ed was actually saying was what they were particularly nervous of, and Brian, we were talking about this again after the game, and it was the fact that they're not. But they've got a particular style. They're playing in a certain way, which is proving to be successful for them. If we were playing at home against Palace and we only had like 40%, 30% of the possession, would I be happy with that? No, I don't think I would be. I think I'd be fuming, and that's the way they've been playing. And when they have been winning games, they've been doing it with very, very little possession and hitting on the counter and being able to take their chances when they come.
Leicester won the league on average with 28% possession. So the possession bit is by the by. It's what you
Yeah.
do with it.
Well, that's exactly and that's exactly how it was panning out, wasn't it, Brian? Yeah, I thought actually thinking that they did have some not many chances, but reasonable chances. But Brugger made the two best saves, and there were occasions when Brighton were. There was the one where Belabor lost the ball, wasn't there? And there was one early on with
Yeah.
Mateta. So there were. They did have some decent chances. I think any nerves from the Brighton point of view is just, I see, I forgot that. What else said there? Palace have actually been playing well, from what I understand. I don't watch them. It might be that the reports exaggerate how well they're playing, but they've definitely been on that upward curve since whatever, April, since they didn't fill the forms in, basically. And so they've been on that sort of, but they are a decent side, obviously. And there is that feeling that no matter how well Brighton have been doing or how well they play, it's almost felt a little bit of what might go wrong, could go wrong up there. That game when they were flying with De Zerbi and had the goal wrongly disallowed and
Yeah.
Sanchez dropped the cross. So I think it's that foreboding of, and I think that was my feelings in the last few
Yeah.
minutes, in that are they going to lose it right at the end? So I think that's why at the end I thought, obviously, I'm mainly thinking about, am I going to get my stuff done? Am I going to do my work? It's not so much. I'm not so much absorbed in the result, but that's why I probably thought at the end, yeah, good point. And it was only then later on, reflecting on the circumstances, that it became a bit more, slightly more disappointing, not hugely.
To be fair, it's actually the Albion who have a bit of a habit of getting last minute, well, certainly equalisers.
Yeah.
I don't think like so much last minute winners, but certainly
Yeah.
equalisers at Nelson Road. And let's face it, let's call this place for what it is. It's Nelson Road, home of AFC Richmond, that Crystal Palace happened to use. That's the
Well,
reality.
I tell you who wasn't nervous going into this game.
Tell us.
That was the people who we saw buying a Crystal Palace and Brighton Hove Albion half and half scarf. What is wrong with you?
I think that it's just, I think personally that it's basically the winter evenings are drawing in, and therefore you
No.
need some fire fuel.
Well, no, the guy selling them was questioned on his sanity, and he said, "Well, I've already sold five. It's the tourists." Yeah, I
Well,
suppose it's almost like the modern equivalent of buying a program, something you buy at a game.
no, no, no,
No.
no. Sorry, Brian. I've got to cut you off there. And I'm saying this because of who our guest is next week, Ian Hine, and his very,
No,
very
but
heavy book.
I'm just
But
asking about, is that now you buy something from the game, which can only be from that game? Is that I'm not I've never bought one, so I don't know, but
no.
just trying to put some sense to it.
No, the only logical time, the only time I could, and I've said this before on the show, the only time I've seen someone who can justifiably wear a half and half scarf was Carlos McAllister at Anfield. He wore a Liverpool Union Saint-Gilloise half and half scarf because one of his boys was playing for Liverpool and one of his boys was playing for USG. In that sense, I think that actually the half and half scarf was a perfect memento of the day in that
What a
sense.
high bar, though, isn't it, to have one
It's a
sun
very
flag for
high
one
bar.
team and one sun flag for the other. It
Kevin's
might
just been
happen
called up,
versus
hasn't he, as
LB
well?
Essex or something, but
Yeah, well, Kevin's just been called up for Argentina as well, so they're actually going to be playing together
Are they going to be playing home alone?
Oh yes, possibly. I see what you
Oh,
did there.
yeah, that wasn't bad,
It
was it?
is nearly that season as well.
It is,
Okay,
yeah.
well, I mean, there are things to take out of the game. But going into the game, Brian, when the team was announced, it was the first time that Fabian had named an unchanged team.
Yeah, it was, and I think you could see it coming. I sort of overheard beforehand the word Joel being mentioned. I thought, is he going to bring him back in? But it was just somebody being told that that was the one change to the actual squad. So I think it was a fairly obvious unchanged team. And the other thing with that was that unchanged team played pretty much the whole game in the previous match. It was the starting 11, but there weren't any changes made, I think, until the 81st minute against Leeds. So it was sometimes you almost think, the unchanged team, whether you should compare it to the team that finished the previous match. But that seems to have been, with what he's had available of late, very much that he stuck with that plan.
Talking
Yeah,
of
because
Joel, I mean
sorry,
Joel. Can I just say, talking of Joel, what is it about referees in London that feel they obliged to book him for a perfectly good tackle?
yeah, I know that was another one. Another of my thoughts, I suppose, later on, will the goal come from such a contentious free kick? Or I don't know if there was a foul
Yeah.
initially, but it did seem a bit, it was right over the far side from us. But
Well, it did seem like he was being booked for like being having his head
putting
in
his neck
underneath
in the way,
somebody's arm, and
strangling him.
it
Yeah.
was like, well, he's in a headlock. It was
Personally, I suspect it was probably for mouthing off at the referee. And let's face it, Veltman is not exactly backwards in coming forwards when looking at an opinion. And I'm going to go back to Ted Lasso again. No, he's not being rude. He's just being Dutch. That's the sort of the famous quote that they do say. But yeah, he got no. I've seen the footage since. He won a perfectly good tackle, and then I can't remember who it was, but basically stuck him in a headlock, and the referee gave the free kick to Palace. Like he did with Chelsea. And I mean, I think, like I say, the booking was probably more likely to be for mouthing off. However, it was a stupid free, not to give away, but to give, because he cleanly won the ball.
Yeah,
But
but
as
yeah.
he said with his rose-tinted glasses on.
But Brian, there were pluses and minuses from the performance. There were too many passengers. There was too many 6 out of 10 performances from some of our players, which we're coming to come to in a minute. But let's look at the ones that did really well in this game. One of which is, I know you've just done a piece about him as well for the Argus, is Diego Gomez,
Oh yeah.
about what his best position is.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, I think he can play that sort of wide of centre, and he did score his goals at Barnsley from that, albeit on the other side. But it feels like he's quite it's just a platform, isn't it? And it's a good position for him when you've got somebody like Ferdi Kavioglu charging up that wing. It probably wouldn't help if you were playing in front of, say, Joel Veltman. But I think Hertzler likes his he's called him a beast in training when he first came over. He likes his physicality, his fitness, his commitment. He's been mixed. I mean, it was quite surprising. When he scored those two goals against Leeds, and it's almost a year since he's been here, I sort of did a thing right on full time saying, this is another example of a player who's had to be patient, and it's quite a long adaptation periods and all this and that. And then when I asked Hertz for that in the press conference, he said, no, I don't agree. I think he's done it quicker than he's adapted quicker than I would have expected. So I don't. And again, he's spoken to me about why he plays him and why he likes him in that position, but he's not likely to tell me, well, I put him there, but I don't really like him there, sort of thing.
No,
So.
I get that bit, but Brian, in that case, I mean, I agree with you. I think it has been a year. I mean, like I say, it was his first goal was against Spurs at the back end of last season, and I
Yeah.
think it has taken him a little bit of time. I mean, he's had good patches here and there, but if Hertzler is saying he's gone quicker than, or coming along quicker than he thought, do you have any inkling or inside sort of info in that case of where the club thought Gomez was when we signed him in the first place, and what the kind of the expectations were?
Not really. I wouldn't have inside info, so to speak. But I mean, you just piece it together from what you hear. But into Miami, it's a step. It's obviously a lower level, isn't it? I thought they were quite excited about is, like I say, though, the physical aspect of him that he wouldn't. And I haven't gone back to check it out, but I seem to remember Hertzler thinking it wouldn't take too long for him to get used to the physicality. So perhaps he was just like being supportive of his player as well. But and I'm not sure, but he does seem to have that versatility as he can play the different roles. Because what happens now when Mitoma comes back? To me, there's an obvious attacking four of Mitoma, Rutter, Minte, and then Welbeck. But then Rutter probably hasn't been as good as he can be. But is that that's how I've sort of seen it for a little while since João Pedro left. That could be the attacking four, and obviously you've got Gruda to come in. Or does Gomez have a place in that? Does he upset that plan? Or does he play, can he play in midfield? And you can have that dream type attacking four, assuming, you know, if they're all on form, they're all playing as they can. That Mitoma, Rutter, Minte playing off Welbeck is quite a good combination. Or as go and also, you know, you're not going to play, especially coming up in these weeks, you're not going to play the same team for 90 minutes for every game. So
Particularly with Christmas coming up.
yeah, so I think he's got that. He's combative. He's got that versatility, and obviously they love the way that he can get into the penalty area. Didn't he did it once actually, didn't he, early on at Palace? But
Well, yeah, I was going to come to that because I mean that was the probably our best chance of the game actually, which he pretty much made himself, like arriving late into the box because he is that box to box midfielder, isn't he? The Danny Wilson, for want of a better comparison.
Crikey, that's 40 years ago, that
is. Well, you know, just like yesterday to me.
is that the Brighton example? I was thinking of Brian Robson on those goals against Leeds, but that one he actually won the ball, didn't he? The Palace, and the flag went up for some reason. I can't quite
I have seen
Jeff
that
Minton.
since. No, I have seen that since. And once the shot came in and the
It was
keeper
after the
saved it,
shot.
Dunk was offside. And that was a correct flag.
But no, but if he'd scored, it would have been onside. It was the
Oh,
rebound that was offside.
yeah. Yeah, it's
But
just
yeah,
one.
it was. But I mean, that could have changed. That would have been a game changer. I
Yeah, we
think.
might have drawn.
Yeah, equaliser in first.
Exactly.
But I mean,
Yeah,
yeah. But
but also what I really liked was the move for, I mean, did he play the right pass on that when he won the ball and started that counter attack on the
and
Minto
set up
belt?
Minty.
I don't know. I don't think you could say he definitely played the wrong pass, and he's trying to play. How many times do you see those sort of attacks break down without even a shot, even if it's like 4v2, 4v3? So I thought that was really good as well from him. But
I think just Minte made it look like a bad pass because he really
yeah,
scuffed it badly.
I think when you look back at it, it wasn't it was a quite a legitimate pass to play.
Well,
And
I mean,
the
Minte
thing is,
had a couple of
if Minte had
chances. And...
used his right peg like he can do, then I think he'd have had a better chance. But he just, I know what he was trying to do is it was a left foot thing, you know, going across the keeper, which he completely and utterly fluffed. And the number of times we're now, because this was bang on half time, the number of times we're seeing Minte look to the skies, put his top over his head, as if to say, did I really scuff that one that badly? It's getting a little bit repetitive now, isn't it? There is a phenomenal player out there who I don't know, does it, what does he, well, he chokes at the last minute far too often. Does he panic? Is he nervous? Is it, he's clearly got, not going to say he hasn't got the talent because he clearly has. And yet, you know, there are times where he can absolutely have his fullback on toast, and there's other times where you think you might as well play at fullback.
Yeah, but he does play at fullback sometimes, and that's what's
Yeah.
loves. That's what I think Hertzler really likes about him as well. The other thing before we move on from Gomez is he is playing in, I think it's in, yeah, San Antonio on early hours of Wednesday for our time next week. So
Yeah.
see what state he gets back in and if he's fit. And because last time he came back from international duty and then he got that whack early in the next game, didn't he? I think. Was it Newcastle? So see
Yeah.
what shape he comes back in. So that's quite they're friendlies, but it's Paraguay, you know, it's a big deal for Paraguay getting ready for the next World Cup. So
Really, yeah.
see what state he comes back in.
But the other thing is well, I mean, we still haven't no, we don't know what the exact prognosis is with Carew, but I would guess that we would hopefully be back after the international break. And if he is coming back in, and that is where Diego is currently playing on that wide on the left position, Carew is obviously going to be first choice in that. So, yeah. I mean, but the elephant in the room is what do you do with a player like Carlos Belliba, because he's clearly not back up to speed yet. Can you carry him? Do you keep playing him, or do you actually take him out of the firing line? Because it's getting to the point where mistakes are becoming more and more commonplace, and actually one of them could have cost us a goal at the weekend.
Yeah, well, Hertzler has been quite consistent in this, that you keep playing him, that he plays his way back to form. But I suppose the question, the debate for fans, isn't it, is can Vifa go in there? Because they haven't had Milner recently, they haven't had Hinchelwood. Well, I see there's footage of him. The club have actually put out video of him doing some training at last.
Yeah, it was on the unlock thing, wasn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, and Hertzler seems to prefer him, Hinchelwood in midfield rather than the fullback role. So then that gives them more of a decision and more options to make, doesn't it? The last game Hinchelwood played, he started in midfield with Milner at Bournemouth, albeit for about 30 seconds. But does he look towards, I know he likes Ayari as well, which, you know, Ayari's got his merits too, but yeah, I think the consistent line has been that Belaba plays on and finds his form, but he obviously very rarely can play the 90 minutes, and he's got AFCON coming up as well, so you think there might be a chance for somebody such as Hinchelwood or Milner to force their way in that role.
Yeah. I mean, I forgot about AFCON, actually. I mean, that could actually do him the world of good. I mean, is Minté going as well?
No, they're not. They're not qualified.
Right. Okay. Well, that is a good thing. But if he goes away and does well for Cameroon, gets his head straight.
That's the point. Is it all about, you know, is it specifically about the whole Manchester United thing from the summer? I mean, and we're getting obviously the messages from the club that he had his head turned, but yeah, you know, does one need a pot of salt even for that? I'm not going to accuse Hertzler of being a liar, far from it, but you know, the summer was quite, well, you know, given how cold it is now, the summer was quite a while ago. And I mean, when we're talking about that particular incident up at Selhurst, where he's turned one way and Wharton's just sort of nicked it off him, and you can see there's a certain lack of concentration, which the Belaba from last season just wouldn't have allowed to have happened. And so even into mid-November, he's still going out on the pitch, not paying attention to what's going on. Surely there must be something way more than just the whole Man United thing, unless he's just looking forward to January. But in January, he's going to be busy.
Yeah, I don't think he'll be transferred in January unless they've changed plans. Certainly the line I got from a very good source was he'll be here for this season. In fact, Tony Bloom has said it on record as well, hasn't he? He's here for this season,
yes, at
least. I know these things can change. I wonder if the way that Brighton play, though, when you have the ball rolled into you with your back to the opponents at Selhurst Park with 20,000 people baying for you to make a mistake, does need a certain level of confidence. And is that confidence quite there, or can it be affected by several below par performances and people like us talking about how you're not playing very well? I don't know.
I believe that the confidence and the belief are there. I just think he's just not paying attention.
Yeah.
The thing is, because, I mean, there have been players in the past who have been playing and have been playing very, very poorly. And the crowd has very, very quickly turned on that player. And actually, everyone has stayed with Belaba because everyone wants him. Everyone knows what the kind of player that he actually is.
I was about to say that because they've seen him play so well, it's like he's almost gained an advanced pardon. Yeah. But that won't last forever.
Yeah, I know. But I mean,
when people are just going to, they're not going to boo him. Anyone who boos him just can get in the sea, as they say from 3 years ago.
I mean, there was
go on.
There was a classic example of it, like years ago. I mean, actually, we've had him on the show and talked to him about it, and that was Robert Codner, who had a really good spell. Then he had a really, really bad spell, and actually, he was like the target of the boo boys for quite a while.
Well, you look at how Murray was target for that in his first time round with us. You know, it's, you know, it, I mean, let's face it: is there anything more fickle in this world, or certainly in this country, than the average football fan? Listen. Carlos, the point is, we know that Carlos Belaba can, whatever it is he needs to do, we know he can do it. And like I say, he's still the clown. He still comes across as the joker. It's just somewhere down the line, he's not the player he was last year. And yet, but the thing is, we could say that, for instance, about Lewis Dunk last season. And yet here he is back to not far off his well, certainly whether it's his best is subjective. But my point would be is he's certainly a person in the centre of defence that I would still be, you know, happy to have there.
OK, well, let's talk about Lewis then. He's just achieved the milestone of 497 games.
Yeah, no, it's interesting the club actually put it out there. It's 500. Yes, it's 500 games for league clubs, but that does include league and cup games. So, yes, 497 for the Albion, 3 for Bristol City. I'd rather celebrate his 500 for the Albion, and it makes him only the second person to achieve that. He's still got 66 games to go after that to equal Ernie Wilson's record. But, yeah, I think that we kind of felt like we identified what the issue was last season. He'd gone with England to the Euros, didn't really get a break, and didn't come back in the best of nick. This time round, he had his pre-season, and I think just looks a lot more confident and less knackered. I mean, there's particularly injury considerations with him. I think has he played every moment of every game so far legally this season?
Yes, he has. Yeah, well, I think he's actually come out this week, Brian, hasn't he? And he's actually said he feels like he's in the best condition he's ever been in.
Yeah, he has said that previously as well. I think that he wasn't in that sort of proper fitness, and it was like Al said, he had such a went off, did his bit for his country in a footballing sense, and he didn't do him any favours. He obviously didn't get any game time, but I think he's, and you could look as well at Danny Welbeck at the start of the season, with players like, obviously he's come back to his best, and say Danny Welbeck had a couple of really poor games, and he's come back very quickly. So when you contrast with Belabor, I suppose it's that it's dragging on a little bit. But Dunk, yeah, he's so important, than is Jan-Paul van Hekker's looking good again alongside him. I know there will be questions asked of centre backs if they're not quite right, and you've got two centre backs you've signed in the summer as well.
Well, that's exactly what I was going to ask you, actually, because it's like with the competition for places now, and obviously particularly with Mascali, who is a player we've been tracking for quite some time prior to him actually coming in. It wasn't just like the one window where we were looking at him. We've been looking at him for quite some time. Having that competition, knowing that any drop, you've got someone who's hungry to take your place. And
capable of doing so.
And absolutely. And exactly the same with Coppola as well, who's obviously going off and away playing for Italy. You know, he's got to be careful, Lewis, because, you know, any drop of form, he could lose his place.
But I think the Albion chasing down the quality that they did, I think one is indicative of the club's aspirations, but two, as we just said, Lewis was not on tip-top form last season, and to actually acquire someone of such quality was, I think, absolutely paramount. The fact that they can't now, these two new signings, or relatively new signings, can't get a sniff in for the league game, I think actually says, well, all you need to know about how certainly Dunk, and let's face it, I think Van Hekker is largely undroppable at present. Yeah, they're all prone to the odd mistake here. They can't necessarily clear absolutely everything, and sometimes they'll lose their man, but that doesn't mean to say they're having an off game. That's just the nature of humanity and being a person within a football game.
Well, but I would say they're both Dunk and Van Hekker are not a million miles away from missing a game anyway. They're both on three yellows for the season.
We know things can change. Remember, the player who did so well in the second half of last season was Adam Webster, so he was a big loss, really, when you look at the form in the second half of last season. And I know the squad themselves were really, they were sort of devastated when that happened in Spain. So that was a big setback. I'm sure Boscagli and Coppola would have expected to play a bit more by now, especially Boscagli. He gives that option as well of the three at the back. I suppose they both do if they go to that, which maybe they will again against Arsenal if it worked well enough in the cup. And the other thing with Coppola, I mean, obviously Boscagli is very experienced, but Coppola, I think it's easy to think of him as a prospect or somebody to come in and develop, which he is to a degree, but he is quite, you know, has got quite a lot of experience in Serie A. And I think one season defending with Verona last season was probably worth about two or three seasons defending with other teams the way that their season went.
Okay, you are listening to the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast. This show is brought to you, Alan, in association with Flowers Unlimited.
Yes, it certainly is. 175 to 177 Portland Road. Now, you mentioned this last week, AD, because you put me on the spot in that way. It was my wife's birthday, well, actually yesterday, so Tuesday this week. And I decided to actually indulge. I thought, well, if they're at least going to sponsor our show, the very least I could do is actually get her some flowers from Flowers Unlimited. I just phoned them up, told them what I wanted. They delivered the next day, which is what I wanted as well. And they made a fantastic job of the very vague description I gave them. Superb.
And Al, did you tell them that you're a Brighton season ticket holder and get 20% off?
Yes, I did. What I actually did do was they gave me a price. Took 20% off, and I said, okay, fine, but charge me the original price, but with that kind of 20% additional thing. So it's kind of a slightly bit more than their regular thing would have. Do you know, if you see what I mean? I'm really explaining this badly. Anyway, here's what they say about themselves. Whatever your reason for sending flowers or gifts, we can help. If it's a birthday, anniversary, birth, celebration, thank you, sympathy, sorry, or anything else, we have the answer. If it's a wedding or a corporate event, our team will come up with something to wow you. If it's a funeral, we can guide you in choosing a tribute that really reflects the life of your loved one. Trust us to provide the service and the quality that you deserve. And in terms of my wife's birthday, I said, do you know what, AD? This is weird, actually. How long have we known each other? 20 years. And I've been married for, 16 months. And it's great to say that I have a wife, and especially the wife I've got. It's brilliant. And what Flowers Unlimited did for us, or for her present yesterday, couldn't fault it. So that's 175 to 177 Portland Road, Hove, or go to flowersunlimited.co.uk. And like I say, as AD just said, if you tell them that you are a Albion season ticket holder, then you'll get a 20% discount. So thanks very much indeed, Dave Costa of Flowers Unlimited, for sponsoring the Albion Roar.
Okay. Now, Brian, back to Selhurst Park and
Nelson Road.
This is a wider discussion, I think, actually. But there was a decision that was made in the game. We got given a penalty, and then the penalty was rescinded. And I can't say I've got any complaints about it. It was actually good VAR.
Yeah, it was. And I think it was the sort of thing which happened in other areas of the pitch that wasn't brought up. Noticed. There probably were a few soft free kicks like that, one way or another.
I did notice that a few of the Palace players had an issue with gravity.
Right. Well,
When you say had an issue, as in using it a bit too much.
Well, they were wearing the wrong boots, and they just managed to find themselves on the deck. I don't know how it happened.
No,
he won Palace nil.
I can remember Mats Wiefer getting a very soft free kick as well when he was facing his own byline, but it just happens. Yeah, it was in the end the correct decision, wasn't it? And it was one of those as well where the referee seemed to take a little while to even give the penalty. Sometimes I'm probably wrong in this, but sometimes I think a whistle goes or a flag goes up, and it's almost like I think that needs looking at rather than I definitely think that was offside, or I definitely think it was one thing or the other. But yeah, it was, I mean, not great for Jorginho, was it? It was, but we've seen players in this fixture do, as you say, go down.
Yes.
I mean, it must be like a rhyming thing. Zaha, Saar.
Rutter lost his footer, and no, it wasn't clever. I mean, you could see what it was. It was sort of like trying to dance through a forest of legs.
Yeah.
And I think probably just, you know, chancing his, excuse the bodily pun, chancing his arm. However, you know, say VAR, I won't say necessarily VAR misses anything. The cameras tend to catch nearly everything. It's obviously the people operating it, and something like that can only be as good as the people operating it. But yeah.
But I think what we've seen as well is how, what I find a bit annoying with VAR is how the celebrations that start when a team gets reprieved because somebody's shoulder or somebody was like 6 inches offside, or they've had an incredible stroke of luck, And then the seller, and this one, it just seemed to change the impetus of the game, change the momentum of the game. You were thinking, I wish he'd never given that penalty in the first place. And there was others. I remember at Man United when there was perceived injustice, and that was when it was a penalty incident with, was it De Kuyper, and the player cutting inside.
Yes, yeah, I think
and
it was.
That again, that fueled the crowd and fueled the team, and you're almost. Yeah, I mean, certainly the Palace one, I was thinking, I wish he never even pointed to the spot, because it seemed to do Palace more of a favour than it did Brighton.
Well, the perverse thing also is that if the referee hadn't given the penalty, would he have automatically booked Rutter for diving? The answer is not necessarily, because, you know, there is this kind of black and white argument to say, well, if it wasn't a foul, it was a dive. And the answer is, of course, there are several shades of grey in between that. So to have just one or the other is absolutely ludicrous. But because he gave the penalty and VAR did look at it, then the referee gave Rutter the yellow card for simulation. Whereas, like I say, it's highly probable if he hadn't gotten it, he'd have just, you know, done that sort of dramatic arms across the chest and out they go, and they say just play on. Because, like I say, VAR can't intervene on a yellow card specifically, only on a penalty decision, of which, you know, the follow-up is that Rutter gets his yellow card for diving. And then let's call it what it was. It was a dive.
And then the referee does his explanation. But as soon as he started to say a few words which indicate which way it's going, you just hear cheers and you don't hear the rest of it. But I was the one that mystifies me is still that Chelsea one where they was kicked in the head. That's the one that's still and I know there's been an explanation for that. But yeah, that seems, I can remember actually sitting there thinking, I wonder if Sanchez is going to save the penalty. But
no, I mean, it was so clear as to, I mean, I mean, that's the other point, isn't it, about VAR. And I know that AD wants to discuss the twaddle that Pierluigi Collina has come up with this week, is sometimes you get VAR almost fabricating their own laws in order to justify a decision. I recall, you know, the game last season, Chelsea against West Ham. Chelsea again, funny that. Chelsea against West Ham, where the West Ham forward is clearly having his arm pulled back. Clearly. And, you know, there was the reasoning or the wording they gave, you think, well, that's not even close to being in the laws of the game. Likewise, I think it was Rutter being... having his shirt, was it either Rutter or Gomez, I can't remember which, having his shirt pulled, clearly ahead of Man United's third goal a few weeks ago. It was Jorginho.
That should have been overturned. It was a clear foul.
Well, of course it was. But, you know, again, VAR coming up with its own justification. I mean, in this instance, the referee didn't give a decision on account of the fact I genuinely don't think he saw the shirt pull. It was on the blind side of him. And I can... you know, take sympathy with that. But VAR is there to say, it's not there to make the referee's life.
No, I mean, it's a conversation we've had a zillion times before. You know, it's with goal line technology, it's black and white. Is it overline? Is it not overline?
Yeah.
Yes, no. You can, that's fine. But with the rest of the decisions that would go on in a football match, it's subjective.
Of course, but a foul is still a foul.
It's in the opinion of. So, one set of officials, including the VAR, might have a completely different view to an identical thing like 60 miles up the road.
Well, given that I think that we've largely exhausted the Palace game, and let's face it, I mean, do we really want to have to mention that those two words sort of several more times? I mean, let's bring in this notion of law changes. And the thing that you've pointed out to me, AD, is that Pierluigi Collina, probably arguably the greatest referee that world football has ever seen, has suggested that...
Well, Clive Thomas would have something to say about that.
True, yeah. Just don't tell the Brazilians. But
Keith Hackett would definitely have something to say about that.
Yeah, but he has suggested that when it comes to a penalty kick, in regular time, that the original penalty taker, should the penalty be saved, cannot follow up and knock it in the same way that, for instance, if he hits the post, the same penalty taker can't touch it. Because what is the reason that Colino is banging on about this is that there's too much horse trading, and he said it's literally like the starting gate in the Palio de Siena, which is a horse race that goes around the main town square, and it's absolutely mental. He said there's too much of that going on. So his idea is the person who takes the penalty kick upon the keeper saving it cannot follow up the rebound. I don't know if you've heard about that already, Brian, but if it isn't, it's the first thing that you've considered. What are your first thoughts on that?
I thought I'd heard a theory that nobody could put in the rebound.
That was the theory I heard.
I was just reading the Italian sort of things, and he said, and obviously they've done a direct translation. He said the original penalty taker.
I thought of getting that in a way. I suppose they've got a head start, haven't they?
That was his point. Yeah,
that advantage, but it doesn't solve the start of the Palio di Siena, because that would be even more of a Palio di Siena.
Exactly.
All the rest would be jostling to put the rebound in. I haven't really got a rule change that is burning, that I've got a burning desire to see. I mean, I sometimes think some of these, like corners, if has the ball gone out or is it flicked off somebody and it gets given the wrong way? That seems ridiculous that you can't give the right decision on that. And I think there have been a few of those recently where either a corner's been given.
Boris have had two, haven't they?
Yeah.
Are you talking about VAR intervening here?
Well, if it's, I don't see why not, but probably somebody will tell me exactly why not. But the laws, just common sense seems to say if the only person in the ground if one of the few people in the ground who didn't see that a ball flicked off somebody's boot and gives the wrong decision, that seems a bit unfair, really. I do think just implementing the rules or the laws, properly is probably the bigger thing than trying to bring some more in. But
well, no, I've got some very
go on, then. I know you've been champing at the bit for your excuse.
Well, no, it's not so much that, but basically, I mean, we've said this before, right? Because the rules of football have been around for hundreds of years, and they largely have stayed the same, give or take a few tweaks here and there. None of them were designed to be micromanaged in the way that it is with the VAR. So things like someone being like a Nat's pube offside, that's not gaining an advantage. I would like to see, if you're going to get someone offside, they've got to be seen as being gaining an advantage. So give the advantage to the attacking team, make the lines bigger. I don't know, but It's not the VAR that's got to change. It's the laws have got to change to incorporate the VAR works.
In that case, with that scenario, AD, where does offside start? Where? Obviously, we're talking about the relative position of the player in question who will be given offside nominally. Where does it start?
Well, it starts with when the ball's being played and where does the players are. But basically, level is onside. And I mean, when I say level, you've got to maybe just make the lines bigger so it incorporates both players. Because Peter Crouch, for instance, you know, he's going to have a lot longer stride than Tarek Lamptey. Tarek could be like slightly ahead and be given offside. It's ridiculous.
But Peter Crouch could be behind Tarek Lamptey and still win the race for the ball. But my point would be is here. Let's look at an example of what happened at Selhurst Park at the weekend. Is that the ball was played through for a Palace forward, and I couldn't tell you which one again, and wasn't flagged offside. And he was a good yard or so offside. There would have been broad daylight. In fact, there was three Palace players that were offside, but obviously it's about the player who receives the ball. Now, he wasn't flagged offside, but if it had gone in, then I think VAR would have looked at it. Oddly enough, I mean, ultimately it went out for a goal kick, but an offside not given, if that would have if that had gone behind off an Albion player, then they get a corner, and the corner is an advantage from an offside. Yeah. So my point therefore is, okay, where do you start the offside? Is it from the linesman's flag? But also, is it, what is the position? You sound about broadening the line, but even then, okay, so there's the broad line, and let's say it's a yard wide. For the sake of this argument, it's a yard wide. So if there's two players within that yard width, both are considered, well, the attacking player is considered level, but then that yard and an inch is then another boundary of which you're then arguing the toss over.
Yeah, there'll always be a boundary, won't there? And then what if somebody is offside and ducks under the ball? Is he offside or not?
Yeah.
What was your theory on this, Brian? Was it offside or not?
Which one's that?
The Liverpool goal the weekend.
I just think if you're ducking under the ball, because we sometimes see like crosses coming in, and the argument is the goalkeeper can't move until he's seen whether that player touches the ball or not. My thought was, if you've got to duck underneath the ball, surely you are, the goalkeeper might not be looking, I don't know, he might not be looking at you, who knows where he's looking, but if you've got to duck under the ball, surely that is...
You're actively involved.
Yeah.
He's standing in an opposite position in the goalkeeper's eye line. It's offside.
Well, it's not even necessarily the eye line. It's, well, which is another matter entirely, looking back at the Aston Villa game from a couple of years ago. But it's also about the fact that, was it Robertson? His duck was so dramatic as well. I mean, it's clear that, you know, he was actively involved. He actively did something to get out of the way. Because if he hadn't ducked, there's a good chance the ball would hit him. And therefore, not only has he stopped a goal, he's offside anyway.
Yeah, sorry for bringing that, diverting our attention.
No,
I totally agree with AD in what you're saying. It's when there's an offside, which is like so minuscule.
Yeah. It's got to be clear and obvious.
Equally, whatever you do, there's always going to be a boundary where it is or it isn't. Even if you say, where does clear and obvious start? Even if you give them a yard, you say you a yard beyond the defender. With anything less than a yard is onside. There's still going to be a point where you're either 2 foot 11 or 3 foot one. So,
once you're at a yard and an inch, then people say, well, that's not what it's there for. The boundary has to be somewhere.
Unless you just don't have offside.
Well, that's
me.
You know, the whole thing, it doesn't take people's body shapes into consideration. I mean, some players have massive arses and they can be ruled off by their massive arses. It's ridiculous.
Sorry, the laws can only cater for it so far.
That is your body. You have to, because you can't say, some players have got longer arms than others, so they're more at risk of giving away a handball.
Yeah.
We cannot play the game where everyone is 5 foot 11 and weighs 12 whatever. It doesn't work that way. So now, if you're talking about sort of laws that irritate you, I mean, I do take Brian's point about whether a corner is a corner, but the fear I would have is VAR getting so involved, because there's now talk of whether they get involved in the second yellow card. And it's not going to be the greatest leap from there to do they get involved in the first yellow card as well.
Mm.
And it's that VAR creep that would concern me. At the moment, it is frustrating because there are decisions you think, well, why hasn't VAR got involved? Like, for instance, you know, a foul outside the area. Well, VAR can't really, unless it's a potential red card offence, VAR can't look at it because it's outside its remit. Okay, do you bring VAR on this? And you think, well, in that case, there is no point in having a referee on the pitch. Yeah. So something that there has to be a certain way in which VAR is kept in its box. And let's face it, the remit that VAR has is not the real screaming point that the vast majority of people have. It's the way it's being administered by people who sometimes just, I mean, and every single fan is convinced that VAR is acting against their club.
Well, there is a really good stat, Al.
Which
the season
is?
The season before VAR came in, the linesman got 94% of the offsides correct.
Right. So what does that mean then? Is there that thing that they don't flag because VAR is there?
Well, there is the thing where they're told not to flag in certain things, isn't there? But yeah,
I can't get my head around that.
I just think that, I mean, I've got a beer in my body about the offside thing anyway. I just think that it just needs to be.
What you haven't really said, AD, is where the boundary is.
But are there any?
It's around the cricket pitch.
Very funny.
Are there any stats as well for how the game might have improved or changed? Players knowing that VAR's there, so not doing things that they would have done before.
Well, I think that Georginio Rutter could actually answer you that from last weekend. So evidently not.
Well, according to Glenn Murray, in his ideal rule changes, he would have been put in a sin bin for 5 minutes for a simulation.
Fundamentally against the idea of the sin bin. It probably works in rugby, but then trying, and I've always said this, trying to administer football by the rules of other games really doesn't work. When we tried it a few years ago with the 10-yard advance every time someone gave the referee some lip. Just don't give the referee lip. Yellow card them and they'll shut up. You know, I like the idea, for instance, of only a captain being involved. But if we're talking about trying to, you know, because there's so much more discipline in rugby, just because there has to be, the sin bin, I don't think will work in football. It will just be the case of, okay, we're down to 10 players. We change ourselves appropriately. And I think it stultifies the game. And then we're back to 11 again. I think that, you know, a lot of managers would just mark time for that 10 minutes.
Well, I was going to say also when we football has injury time added on at the end. So sometimes, you know, if there's 8 minutes added on, the player who's been off for 5 minutes, how much were they actually off for? Might be, I don't know how you would gauge whether they missed 5 minutes of football or just 5 minutes of players wiping the ball.
I mean, it's interesting, actually, something else that I think it was Hertzler said, or I assume he said
about the throw-ins.
It was about throw-ins. It's not so much about the long throw-ins. It's about he wants a time restriction placed on long throw-ins because they take forever. You got, you know, the ball boy's got to wipe the ball for you. The player themselves will wipe the ball. You got to rev up. You've got to get everyone in position. It's like setting up a free kick. And it takes forever. I mean, there's talking of stats, there's stats out there where there's a chart of the average time a team takes to take a throw in. I think Brentford are the worst.
Yeah.
And they average, and I mean average, 35 seconds to take a throw in. That is shocking. You know, even if that means that one throw in is 20 seconds after it's gone out, that means that the next one to average it out is 50 seconds. You know, don't get me wrong, I think the players just want a breather now and again. To run around manically for 90 minutes isn't going to happen, but.
Well, there is that because that has been mentioned, in particularly when people have been talking about player injuries and things like that. The fact because we've got the multi-ball system now, you know, the players used to be able to get a breather when the ball went out, but now because I can just grab the nearest ball and get straight on with it, unless you're Brentford, obviously.
They're not getting that breather. Even then, the shortest team was only something like 21 seconds. So even then, 20, like I said, yes, it's every team is clearly having a breather for that.
Brian?
I'll tell you what, in my early days of covering non-league football, I actually covered the Isthmian League when they had kick-ins. So imagine that and I think every rule will be interpreted in different ways. And pretty much every law or rule can be interpreted in a good way or a bad way or a lot of them. And I saw games in that where everything became like a free kick. Every time there was a throw-in, somebody went over and players went forward and they launched it. And I saw games where it was like watching a five-a-side game, and when the ball went out, put the ball down, play a five-yard pass. So, no, I haven't got any. Just get the keep administering the laws as they should be. Keep that accurate, I guess.
What we want, Brian, here is like we want to bring in the Sibutio rule of someone like throw ins. Basically, someone's got to be standing behind the player and throw the ball against the player's head for it to go in.
Did I see Ferdy Cadioglu doing a semi long throw on Sunday? Is my memory playing tricks with me?
I can't remember. I can't remember. But Ferdy was very good. Okay, well, let's just move it on from that. We are running out of time. Obviously, there was a lot of talk going into the week, last week, of Danny being called up to go away with England this week. It didn't happen. We think that's possibly a good thing at this time. Brian, thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, would have been nice for him, wouldn't it? I think it was media encouraged. There was probably, because it's Danny Welbeck, and it was a good story that was latched onto. We certainly had one reporter from one of the tabloids who came down for those two. One of the nationals who came down for those two games, Leeds and Newcastle. And it not specifically to do that story, but when you're looking for a story angle, Danny Welbeck for England is quite an easy one to come up with, rather than is Diego Gomez playing in the right position or something. So I think, and then obviously, you know, Monday Night Club picked up on it, didn't they? BBC, I think probably Sky did. So I couldn't quite tell with Hertzler, because every time you asked him in the press conference, and he did get asked a lot, he smiled as if to say, I couldn't work out was, yes, I know, and I'm not telling you, or whether it was like, oh, is that question again? But I mean, what's two?
Or is it, or hang on, or is it, I'm German, I don't care?
No. Well, hopefully German managers do care about England.
Of course, but, yeah.
Yeah, so he said the door's still open as an E-Tuchel, but I think he's not going to say the door is shut.
I'm very much of the opinion that Danny will be going to the World Cup at the moment.
So he's.
I don't think he's going to be in the squad until the end of the season, and he might be, because until such time as an outstanding candidate comes forward to be an able deputy for Harry Kane, and particularly the squad size, if they can take 30 players in the squad, he's certainly a good option to have around, and he's got the experience and the know-how.
But then
particularly if you need to see out a game.
I think that begs the question, why hasn't he been picked now then to get used to playing alongside those England teammates?
Because I guess he's the type of player and the type of character who could slot in. He doesn't need that. And I think also he's still waiting a little bit on Watkins, because he spoke a bit about in the... It's not the right time to bring him now. He's not fit or whatever it was. But let's see how he is in March. So I still think he's waiting on him as well. I don't know if Welbeck has to go in and play these games to get used to playing alongside others. I think you're right. Is he replacing Jack Hinchwood as your Brighton player at the World Cup?
Well, at the moment.
Yeah, but you never know. I mean, he did say...
Adam Webster.
We've seen... Scott from Bournemouth, haven't we, come in? So, and again, he's saying it could be a chance if a young player can do well. Don't rule Hinchwood out yet. But no, and I think you're right. I wouldn't say that's it necessarily for Welbeck. I mean, Jamie Carragher was saying get him in for this squad, but don't take him to the World Cup, which I didn't
make sense
really agree with at all. But the key thing for Brighton is that if in April people are still talking about Danny Welbeck going to the World Cup, that can only be a good sign.
Yeah, that means he's been playing well for us.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, and with that, that is all we have time for this week. So thank you, as always, to Brian Owen. Thank you to Alan Wares. I've been AD Packham. This has been the Albion Raw on Radio Reverb, 97.2 FM, online at RadioReverb.com, on DAB, and, of course, on our podcast and in association with Flowers Unlimited. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you again soon. See you then. Bye.
Treating your woman.